And we are on Exodus lesson 5. Oh, by the way, does anyone have their verse to say? I had one person say
it. I
can
attest. Kathy said it beautifully on the board. She told me she just had it after she was...
She's already on the board.
I can say it, I think.
Okay.
Okay. I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage. I will also redeem you with an outstretched arm and strong judgment. Then I'm having stage fright. That was happening. I knew it perfectly before. Okay. Then, let's see, just a minute. Help me out. Then I will take you for my people, and I will be your God, and you will know that I am the Lord who brought you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land which I promised to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord.
Excellent, Pam. Very good.
And on it this morning, I thought there was no way. And then I worked on it on the way here and thought, okay, all of a sudden...
Just clicks.
As an encouragement to anybody.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we only have about, what, maybe 4 weeks or 3 weeks left to say it? No. Remember, either come say it to me, write it to me, say it on voicemail, which is how Jen said it last week, put it on my driveway, however you want to say it, email it to me. Just try to work it in so that you understand. Mainly because these verses are a picture of our salvation. And I think it's so important for us to understand that the picture of our salvation isn't just that God saved us, that God is taking us to heaven. Because that's not this. There's so much more, and we miss the life that he has for us if we don't see all of this, the bringing us out from under the burden, from that burden of believing that life is a transaction, all of that. So this is one of those verses that's really key to understanding our salvation, what God has done and is doing, which is what we're going to talk about today, is what he's doing. So we're at the point of the verse. He's already brought them out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. He has taken them out of their bondage. He is now redeeming them. And remember, redeeming has two parts. Redeeming is always, remember SNH Green Stamps, you take something worthless and you pay for it to be worthwhile. So you give, you redeem, you take away the worthlessness and you give worth. So he's already taken away their worthlessness. He's taken them out of the slavery. He's told them that they're no longer slaves. In fact, that's why he has them dressed in traveling clothes. You're no longer a slave. That's why he has all those possessions to give them, and you're no longer a slave. Now I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to make you worthwhile. In fact, I'm not just going to make you worthwhile by making you look good or making you a people that's just an amazing people. I'm going to do it by making you my people. So this is what he's doing in the redemption. So these each connect with one another. So he's now going to give them worth by making them his. Just like... a king would do, you know, let's think about all the fairy tales. You know, a king takes, you know, a peasant girl and makes her his wife, and all of a sudden she's a queen and has worth, right? That's what he's doing here. So he's beginning that process with them. So the redemption process is the fact that it's a process, that there's several steps in it, that it's not just a one thing, but there's several steps in it. And in making them his, he's going to start just like we make our own children ours. We've taken them out of the bondage of the womb, right? And this is a place they know. And now we're going to take them into the world and we're going to make them ours. So he's going to do it the exact same way, kind of what we've talked about before. He's going to treat them as newborns. And so as treating them as newborns, we're going to start to see how he establishes for them a rhythm, a schedule, so that they can live in his world, that they can be comfortable and safe and thrive. That's his whole point, is to grow them so that they can thrive, so that they can have life. And so he's got to start them out just as a newborn. And we'll see this over and over again, how he brings them through the stages. So the redemption process is a process that you need to know. But also the redemption process is still going to go through those three layers that we talked about, that there's always the three layers to see. So there's going to be the story layers, the first layer being the actual circumstances that we see right there. The second layer being the unexpected reactions and actions by God and by them. So we're going to see some, you know, very unexpected things, the actions of God telling them, oh, turn around now. I want the Egyptians to think you don't know where you're going. So, and right there, I mean, this is a principle of God. The way he works for the world says, this doesn't work. This is crazy. This is foolish, as the New Testament says. The ways of God look foolish. And so this is what God is going to do. That's the second layer, the foolishness of God, what God does. And then the foolishness of even the Israelites, of their reactions to what God does. But the third layer is the real story of what God is really doing by working out covenant, how he's working out covenant in the circumstances and in the unexpected reactions and responses. And he will always begin in this part of it by treating them as the newborns. So that's why I want us to start thinking about how we put our newborns on a rhythm, or at least a healthy way to bring them into our family is to put them on a schedule, a rhythm. We've talked about rhythms before. Rhythms are very important. We tend as independent Americans not to think much about rhythms, but rhythms are very important. I mean, the rhythm of the seasons is very important for our body. I mean, think about the rhythms of the seasons. They go through, you know, beautiful growth and beauty and, summer, big activity, right? Fall, we start to see all the death. And I'm sorry, but this week, death was beautiful. This was the first week that the colors actually came out. And I don't know who I was with, but I kept saying, look at that. That's death. Look at that. That's death. I mean, this is all beautiful, this death of shedding stuff, shedding all of the green to see what's underneath. So the beautiful death. But winter is time of rest for our bodies. We slow down. We slow down our activities, all of that. This nice death, which is a rest, ready to sprout up new earth again, our new life again. So God has instilled rhythm within us. So whether we decide we don't like it or not, it's still a part of life. It is how God has arranged life, and it's how God will treat us in rhythms. So this is what we're going to see, is how he begins to instill rhythms for his people, and to see how that is so healthy. So we're going to look at how God is redeeming, how his actions are leading to redemption. And we just talked about what redemption is, making them his by treating them as a newborn, by getting them ready for the life that he has for them, just like we do with a newborn. So let's go through the story of Exodus 14. We first have God directing them at the very beginning to do this strange about face. It looks like they're going one way toward Israel, and now they're going to go down south. And he gives them words, go this way, I want you to go this way. But he also does something to Pharaoh. And we've already talked about hardening his heart. He gives Pharaoh over basically to Pharaoh's desire, right? And that is to be as far away from God as possible. That's that hardening of the heart. And so he gives Pharaoh over to that. And now we have Pharaoh chasing the Israelites. And he sends all of his best chariots and horsemen. And I hope you noticed how many times he said chariots and horsemen, chariots and horsemen, chariots and horsemen. Why? Why is it such a key word there?
Because that's his ambition. That's his support.
Good. That's exactly. That is basically man's strength. So when you see chariots and horsemen in Scripture, almost always it's man's strength, man's strength, man's strength. And eventually he's going to tell Solomon what? Don't go back to Egypt to get chariots and horsemen. Don't do it. Don't go after man's strength. I will give you strength. And of course, we know that Solomon got rich and went back to Egypt and went and got them, and then sold them to the whole world. Sold man's strength to the whole world. So,
something I noticed this time in studying this that I'd never noticed before was in Exodus 14:7. He took all of his chariots.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was nothing left in Egypt. He took them all.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, he really decimated himself. knowing.
And his country.
And his complete country.
Right.
And knowing that this God that he was up against had already done everything possible, and yet he did that in the face of that, because he still believed that his strength was more. Mm-hmm. So, and that's a common, I think, attribute of man. Okay, so what happens? How do the Israelites take this? They follow God's directions to go south. Then the Egyptians start chasing after them. How do they react?
What did you do? There weren't enough graves in the area to bury us, so you've taken us here to be slaughtered.
This is what you say, Israel?
Okay.
It sounds so Jewish, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There aren't enough graves in
here.
I can't
even hear it.
I took a little picture, a funny little face going, yikes. This is what you say.
I want you to read verse 10. Somebody read that out loud for me. And the first time Israel does something, stop. Who wants to read that?
I will.
Okay.
As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked.
Okay, what did the sons of Israel do? Where'd they look? They looked back at Egypt. Sounds kind of like Lot's wife.
Yeah.
Sounds like Abraham, all those, the stories of Abraham. What was it about? Where was he to look? Walk by faith, not sight. So they're walking by sight. This is why he has this in here. This is why we look at the words and particularly the verbs here. So Israel looks. They look at the fact that Egypt is coming after them. And they also look at the fact of the terrain of where they're at. They're looking at the first layer, the circumstances. Oh, no. This is horror. So, of course, they become frightened, right? You look at that, and of course you're going to become frightened. That's almost a given. If you're looking at the circumstances, you're going to become frightened. And then they do as Carmel told us. they start to grumble. Yes. Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way? Why have you brought us out of Egypt? I mean, the words they use there, when God says, I will bring you out of Egypt, and I will deliver you from their bondage, and I will redeem you. And they're saying, why did you bring us out? Why? They're questioning why God has saved them. Why did you bring us to a place that we don't like this place? But I think the more condemning grumble is that later. What do they say next?
Leave us alone that we made. They said that they didn't want to leave in the first place. They wanted to stay slaves.
Yes, yes. It would have been far better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. Okay, first of all, God says they're not going to die in the wilderness. God says, I'm bringing you to a place. So obviously, they're not believing. And they say it would have been much better for us to be slaves, to serve the Egyptians, to live in a place where we were slaves. Have you ever said that? Mm-hmm. Have you ever been in a hard place, you've looked at what's going on and say, oh, it would have been much better for me not to have gone through that? Yeah?
Give me liberty or give me death.
Mm.
I have a son who's been having a hard time, and he just keeps saying, how come everybody is non-Christians? Kids, they all seem like they get it and they're doing fine. Yeah.
Yeah, all the time, all the time. And I want us to start thinking about how we react, not just in our vocal words, but in our words in our head. Because I think that's where we have the grumbling more often. And we're going to talk a lot about grumbling. So we have them grumbling. They're reacting to what they see. When I live by sight, I will always react. I will go again and say, this is not good. This, I don't like this. I don't like that. When I walk by faith, I will say, oh, God is working out covenant here. I'll wait and see him working it out. So, God says, how does God deal with their grumbling here? What does he say to them?
I hear
you. Yep.
Why are you crying out to me?
Before that.
Oh.
Verse 13.
Don't be afraid.
Okay, let's read that whole thing because this is a beautiful verse. Somebody read it for me.
13 or
14? 13.
13. But Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever.
And keep going, one more verse.
The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent.
Okay. I mean, if you read that and just kept going, sad. Stand by and see what the Lord is going to accomplish for you. And how are you to stand by and see?
Silently.
Shut up.
Close the yappas.
Stop talking. Stop the action of your words and see what God is doing. And we will talk much more about this. So I just want us to stop at these places that are really amazing at what he's telling them to do.
Jill, can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
Silent and listen have the same letters.
Oh my gosh. That's pretty cool. Oh, mix it up. Mix up the letters. Silent and listen.
Oh.
That's cool.
Was that at 2 o'clock
in the morning? All these years, I can't believe I never.
Okay, that's very good. That's really cool. Yeah. That's Trish. That's great. That will definitely
so does
keep
God
in our.
And God.
Oh, I need to sing in
my praying dog.
Okay. So we have them, and then of course we have 15. Robin, read 15 for me. This is interesting because usually when they cry out, he listens and then he gives. But he's saying at this point, why are you crying? Go and get what I have for you. Go, watch, watch, just watch. Stop crying and watch. I mean, have you not had your child at some point in their life be crying and crying and you're trying to give them something and they're crying so hard, they have their eyes all squeezed in and they're just crying that they're not even seeing, no, I have what you need here. And they're just crying. Has that ever happened?
Sure.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. Stop crying. Look, would you look? Would you just look? Open up your eyes here. So we have then, of course, him directing Moses to open up the sea for them. And we have this beautiful picture of him opening the sea at flood stage. Remember, there's been a purpose. We've known all along during the plagues what time of year it is. We know that they left Egypt in spring. So there's all of these little hints that God says, no, I'm telling you when it was. I'm telling you it was during flood stage. So all of the historians and say, well, it was probably during the dry season. There was hardly any water there. So we know that it was during flood stage. It was definitely lots of water that he built up into heaps. And, of course, at the direction of Moses' staff. So we have this parting of the sea. Every time I think about this, I think about, of course, the Ten Commandments, the movie with Charlton Heston in it, and I think about how they did the parting of the sea. Does anyone know how they did that? That was actually Jell-O.
Oh.
It was Jell-O that was almost formed, and then they just put a fan in, and it actually did that. So for some reason, I always think about, yeah, that was interesting how they had to think about how to do that. And at some point in, I think, Deuteronomy, it talks about how he gels the sea to be able to make it stand up. So we have the parting of the sea, and then he leads them through what? There's always this
dry land,
not muddy land, dry land, completely dry land. He leads them through. I did forget. Right before that, remember he's been leading them by what?
The cloud.
By the cloud during the day and fire at night. What does he, remember, that's his presence, the cloud and the fire. And we will see that throughout Scripture, his presence in the cloud and the fire. Where else do we see his presence being signified as in the cloud or in the fire?
The
in the tabernacle, we have that. Where else? Holy Spirit, the fire, the Holy Spirit, and
the smoking pot
and the flowing flame, right, through the covenant. Anywhere else?
Burning bush.
Where else a cloud? Let's think about the beginning of Jesus' ministry.
The dove.
Yes, the dove comes out of the cloud and speaks. His voice comes out of the cloud and speaks. This is my beloved son. So we have it all through Scripture. So this is his presence. What does he do with his presence right before? Remember, they're in this valley. And so we have here's the Red Sea, and there's this like beach here, and then there's mountains here and here, and there's this little pass. They're this 1.5-2 million people, and here are the Egyptians coming this way. That's the beach. This is the Red Sea. Okay, so where does his presence go?
Behind them.
Behind them. Why?
So that the Egyptians can't see.
He then confuses the Egyptians and makes the chariot wheels
yep.
go different directions.
So when his presence goes behind, the presence has always been there to lead, but now what's it doing? It's protecting. And it's separating them. These are my people. These are not my people. These are my people that have come under my protection. I will protect them. I will be before them to lead them. I will be behind them to protect them. So here he has this beautiful picture of that. And of course, the interesting thing is that flame stays there while they go through the Red Sea. It's like, don't touch my people. You have no ability to touch my people. They just stand there. He leads them through with Moses parting the sea, and then he confuses the enemy. Remember, all of this is done at night. This is the whole Red Sea crossing goes happens at night. They pass through, and then obviously God takes away the flame and confuses the Egyptians, allows them to start passing through the same thing, right? And what happens?
The waters come back,
right?
They get stuck in mud.
So interesting. Mm-hmm. The Israelites, almost 2 million Israelites, go through on dry land, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, the land is muddy. Mm-hmm. The water starts seeping back in. They confuse. The chariots get their wheels stuck, and they say, "Oh, this God of theirs is fighting. We need to leave." And they can't even leave. So they have now they're the ones who are stuck. They are stuck in the mud, literally. And this is what this movie shows. They've gone underground, under the water in the Red Sea, and have all these in forests and stuff. When things get old and they stay, they fossilize, right? But underwater, coral grows. And so what they have is all these coral chariot wheels underneath the Red Sea that they found. So that's kind of what that movie shows, is that, they'd be able to see that. So, and it's really fascinating. You look and nobody has to tell you what it is. You know exactly what it is. You see these chariot wheels that are all coralized. So we have them completely drowned, all of the Egyptians completely drowned. And so, of course, Israel is saved from the enemy. And they are on the other side now of the Red Sea. They see the death, and they see what God has done. We have chapter 14 having finished. And they, because they saw, what's the end of chapter 14, 31?
Oh, here do we now believe, mm-hmm. saw your great power, here
Now, it's an interesting verse because our first reaction is, oh, good, yes, they believe. But why did they believe?
Because they saw.
So it was a reaction, not a response to God's character. And that's key because we cannot keep going back and forth and say, oh, Israel believed. Oh, now Israel's not believing. Israel believed, now it's not believing. Their belief is based on what they saw. So the belief here is on shaky ground. Does that make sense? Because they are they're reacting to what they saw. But so for this point, I mean, this has happened before to them, exactly back in Egypt. So they believe. Now they believe in the Lord, and now they believe in Moses. They were grumbling before, but now they're going to believe in
so him, what they saw.
Yeah.
Exodus, that God wasn't doing it for them to believe. I mean, God was doing it. I want the other folks to
right.
see it. You're supposed to be trusting me by faith.
Exactly. So, and he does say this. The reason I'm going to do this great thing is so that Egypt believes, and we notice who else actually understands the strength of God because of that.
The other nations.
He starts listing the other nations in the next chapter of all of them that see what God has done. In fact, 40 years later, when they finally enter the land, there's a mention of those nations remembering what God did 40 years ago. Interesting, because Israel forgets. But the other nations have not forgotten who this God is and the strength that he has. So, what's the deep layer here? What's God really doing? We see the circumstances, they're in trouble. We see this unexpected action on God's part. He parts the seas. And he not only parts the seas, but he lets them go through on dry land. He kills the Egyptians. Amazing. And Israel reacting to what they've seen, that they, oh God, now we believe you. Kind of like if you didn't believe that your husband is supporting you, but then you go to work one day and you go to work with him and say, now I believe you really are supporting me. I mean, how does that make him feel? Like, this is, I don't want you to believe because you see it. I want you to believe me. I want you to trust me. So here's the deep layer. First and foremost, he is separating his people from the world. They're mine, definitively mine. I'm showing the world they are mine. And I'm doing that by giving them protection. I'm going to protect them. Just think about this. When you brought your first newborn home from the hospital, what'd you do?
Car seat.
What else?
Blankets.
Okay, did you call your neighbor and say, hey, you want to come with me and pick up my newborn with me? And, you know, you can hold him in the back seat. How did you react with your first? Oh, you were like, and bringing him in the house, and just, I mean, this was, they're mine. No, you can't have them. They're mine. And this is what God is doing. These people are mine. In a very visible, very concrete way, these people are mine. I am separating them for me. Secondly, what he's doing is protecting them fiercely with his strength. He is showing them, this is definitive man strength, all the strength he can muster. Every chariot that Egypt has, the biggest world power at the time, and all these chariots, it's like nothing compared to God's strength. Look what God can do. Not only do they show no ability to fight God, man, but even the waters can't. The waters just do what God says for them to do. So man or nature, neither is going to stand in his way when it comes to his people. He's going to protect them through every strength and power he has. So underneath, he is showing them, I am going to protect, I am going to defend you, I am going to separate you for my own. This is what covenant is all about, right? Covenant says, I will protect you, I will defend you, I will be with you always, you will always be mine. This is what God is doing underneath, showing that. And this is what Israel should have come out of saying is, wow, God really wants us to be his. This show of power isn't This is what we think about miracles. We think it's a show of power of to dazzle us. It's not. It's a show of, I want life for you. I want you to be mine. Does that make sense? That's that underlying thing that we rarely see or rarely think about. And that's what God wants Israel to see right now.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
This was kind of a big realization for me, and I don't know if I will be able to make sense, make it sound good when I say it, but I realized reading about this grumbling that anytime I grumble, if I feel like someone has wronged me or... yeah, I guess when I feel like someone has wronged me, that everything is filtered through the hands of God, and I'm really grumbling against God, you know, and it was just really eye-opening for me. Like, I really don't have just a deeper understanding of God being my defender.
Right.
You know, I really have no reason, I don't have any right to grumble about anything, because God, all gone.
Yep.
It has all passed through his hands
right.
to me.
And that's exactly why we say Israel reacts and why we need to know it. Because you react when you live in only the first or second layer. When you don't live in the third layer, when you don't live in the fact absolutely holding on to God is working out covenant, you will react, and reactions will bring grumbling. So it is exactly what you said, Robin. When I'm not living in that third layer, I absolutely know God is working out covenant. So I walk out the door here and I get hit by a car, or a car almost hits me. And what's my first thought? To grumble, right?
Or make them pay.
Or make them pay. Or, you know, oh, I don't like this. And we'll talk about grumbling a little bit more, but it is, am I living in that third story? Am I living in the real story that God is working on covenant? He is providing and protecting for you, even and especially when you don't see it. And especially when it doesn't look like what you consider to be protection and provision. And we're going to, that gets deeper and deeper as we go into this story. He purposely does things so that you're ready to accept things that you normally wouldn't have as what you thought was good. So, good point. That's exactly what Israel is doing here. Just as an aside, so you don't think I'm skipping this over, because this is always another layer of the stories in the Old Testament. These are all pictures of Jesus Christ. The whole Old Testament is God telling you, I'm trying to restore you, and I want to give you a picture of what it's going to look like when that comes to fruition, when it is fulfilled. And the picture always corresponds to who Jesus is. So here we have, and there's many, many places we could go, but basically here is Jesus is the word that sanctifies. Remember, we already talked about that he is the word, right?
Right.
And the word sanctifies. And sanctifies means to make holy, but in its real content, it means to separate for. To separate not from, but to separate for. To separate for him. To be his. So, Jesus is the word that sanctifies. This is what he does to us. He is that flame that says, hang on, world, they are mine, and you're not touching him. I mean, Jesus says this over and over as he's praying to his father about the disciples. They're mine. You've given them to me, and no one is going to be able to touch them. No one will be able to snatch them out of my hand. This is what's happening here.
I think of that song. I mean, I was thinking of a song, but I know that my Redeemer lives. It's like, yeah, I'm going to send a Redeemer for you, and it's going to keep coming up.
Yep, perfect, exactly. And to think about that word Redeemer in this context makes that song much more flavorful, and to see what's actually going on here. Okay, so we have chapter 14. Chapter 15, we come and we see them singing to the Lord. Yay! They're finally have this beautiful expression, and it's a beautiful song, poetry, that Moses and the sons of Israel sing. And basically what they do in singing is they recount what they have seen. They recount what God has done. They saw God's power, and they saw God's holiness. As we go through this, he mentions his holiness a couple times. And they recount why he's done it. So not just what he's done, that he's taken them through the sea, that he's destroyed their enemy, but why he's done it, which is really important. So the recounting, and this is important when we get to what this really is not just what God has done, but why he's done it. And this is really important, because a lot of times if we just stay with what he has done and take it away from why he's done it, we lose the essence of him fulfilling covenant for us. So why has he done it? Because of his character, who he is, loving kindness, because of his love for us. He wants, and remember, I hope you always remember some of these definitions. The definition of loving kindness is to treat someone as if they belong to you in family. So this is exactly what God is doing. Why is he doing it? Because he's treating us as his own children. He is saying, you're mine. That's why he's doing it. He's also doing it, it says in 13, in thy strength thou hast guided them to thy holy habitation. That's a huge thing. Remember, they've been in Egypt, and depending on where they were in Egypt, it was somebody's realm, some God's realm. And he's saying he's bringing us to his presence. That is why he's doing this, so we can be in his presence and live with him. But also to show Egypt and the nations who he is. So when he shows the world that we're his, he's also showing, when he shows us that we're his, he's also showing the world that we're his. Not a, you're not, and they are. It's, don't you want to be too? It's that invitation again. It's always, remember, God is always inviting in all that he's doing. So we have them singing to the Lord, and it's a beautiful, beautiful song. And we even have Miriam now, Moses' sister. And this is important for us to know here, so we know when later what she does. She was a leader. So she obviously was the leader of the women here. And she began leading the women in singing and praise, which is unusual. We don't have that often in the Old Testament, having the women doing the same praising as the men. And we could talk about that too, but we'll go on. So we have...
Question.
Yeah.
I read this recently before studying it, and in 20, Miriam is identified as Aaron's sister.
Yep.
Why do you think that?
Why do you think?
He's the oldest.
Aaron's the oldest.
Part
yep.
Of the Levites.
Yep. Yep. What kind of a relationship did Moses have with Miriam?
Oh, it was like secret. Did he know?
Yeah, I mean, they haven't really had a relationship, and they would not have looked at Miriam. Israel wouldn't have looked at Miriam as belonging to Moses so much as belonging to Aaron. They knew that that was a family thing. This all of a sudden, I mean, just think about it. If you had a kid who had been adopted out when he was a baby and he comes back 80 years later, oh yeah, they're sister and brother. I mean, it would always be a, oh yeah, forgot that. So that's why we name him here. And later there'll be a reason why she's named differently. So we have the singing, and then Moses is able now they believe Moses once again. Remember, they didn't for a while, then they did, now they didn't, now they do. He's leading them from the Red Sea, and they go out to the wilderness, and they went how far?
3 days.
3 days in the wilderness, and they found no water. So let's remember this. There's a reason why they have 3 days. 3 days from what? From the time they walked on dry land through the Red Sea, when they saw the powerfulness of God, when they saw his might, and they saw him bringing them to him, making them his. 3 days. And then what do?
Grumble.
And they grumble. And they grumble about what?
Water.
Water. Interesting. Because 3 days ago, what did they see God do?
And they were just praising him.
They praised him for having sovereignty over water. And now they're saying, we have nothing to drink. There's no good water. What's going on here? They're living again by sight. You see, when you're not living in that third story, you're living by sight. 3 days is an eternity because you don't see what you think is good, what you consider as good. And so we have them grumbling again. What shall we drink? I mean, it's so interesting that they would go to water right away and grumble about water. So
they also, they didn't learn to go to God with their concern.
Exactly.
They did previously. They went and to Pharaoh for their concern.
Exactly.
Instead of to God.
Exactly. Exactly. So this is what we're doing. So this is a good place to talk about grumbling. Grumbling. It means to complain. And I'll give you the other definition when we get there. But the complaining is not to the person's face who they are grumbling against. Grumbling, when we talk about grumbling in the New Testament, grumbling is always a low murmur behind someone's back. So it's, we want them to hear it, but we don't want to say it to their face. So it's this, I mean, look, okay, kids do it to us all the time, right? You say, go clean your room. And they don't say, Mom, why do I have to clean my room? They say, I don't want to clean my room. And they walk off saying it under their breath. It's that murmuring sound. They're complaining, but they don't want to complain to the face. Because God never says, don't complain to me to my face. In fact, he says, and David does it all the time, I will complain and lament day and night to you, God. God says, fine, do that. Because what are we supposed to be doing? Staying in the conversation. They've never even entered the conversation. They're grumbling on the side. They're grumbling to Moses. Oh, it's safer to do it to Moses. I don't want to do it to God. I don't want to talk to God. So it's this underneath complaining there. They don't go to God with her. They don't say, God, how are you going to provide us with water? God, we don't see any water here. What should we do? They grumble. What are we going to do about water? But not to God. So anytime you see grumbling, it's never to God's face. It's always on this kind of on the side. But they want to make sure he hears it. Does that make sense?
But don't they maybe not go to God because they have looked to Moses, God has spoken to Moses, and Moses has conveyed the message. Everything's been done through Moses. Mm-hmm. Moses' part, they watched Moses. I mean, they knew it was God, but they watched Moses stretch the staff out. So would they have maybe thought, we need to take this to Moses? What would make them think they could go directly to God?
Well, how would they? What would be a way they could have gone directly to God and still do it to Moses?
They could have asked Moses.
Yeah, exactly. So that would have been, they could have still done it that way. They could have said, Moses, would you ask God for us at this point?
This grumbling business is a not bending of their will.
Mm-hmm.
It's not confronting the issue.
Yep.
Being stubborn in your own way, wanting to go your way, and so that you object to going the way that God wants you to go, but you don't tell him. You just go your way.
Right.
I'll go mine. I'll grumble about it. I'll do it because you'll kill me if I don't. I'll grumble about it. So it's this will business again. My way or.
And when we get to the next part, I will give you the full definition, and then you're gonna take that and go, oh, that makes a huge difference. How does God react to their grumbling?
He provides.
So here's interesting. Israel keeps reacting to what they see, living by sight, but does God react? No, he keeps on responding. He keeps on doing what he always does. He provides because he's a covenant God. He's faithful, so he's going
to
provide here.
He planned to do this anyway. He didn't do it because they grumbled.
Absolutely. That's what I mean. He's not reacting to them. He's going to give them. And there's a purpose. There's a purpose always for him to not show us what we think we want and see. And we'll talk about that in a minute. What does he make Moses do? He doesn't just say, oh, now the water's sweet. What does he do? He tells Moses to throw in a tree. Is that odd? It's really strange, right? God is going to keep doing this over and over again to remind them, my ways are not your ways. What I do looks strange. I want you to start getting used to this because I don't want you to be looking for your picture. My picture is completely different. And I'm going to throw in a tree. And trees have big significance. It's one of the reasons I have my house in a tree theme. Trees are hugely significant here. a tree making something bitter. Does anyone makes it sweet, makes a bitter sweet. Does anyone think about a tree in the New Testament? The cross. So the cross is called a tree. It is the bark of a tree, or the trunk of a tree. Throwing a tree into bitter water to make it sweet, when we think about Christ's death, is who would have thought that Christ dying would bring life? It doesn't make sense to us. And in the world, the Romans felt like they were victorious over Christ. And God's saying, I don't work that way. I work differently. I throw trees into bitter water and they are sweet. This is, I work completely different than what you think, than how you picture things coming. So that when you start looking for life, don't start looking for what how the world says you get life. I work differently. So this is just the beginning of him teaching them how he works, his ways. So Moses throws the tree in, and the waters become sweet. And then he directs them to listen. So over and over and over again, we have God saying, Israel, listen to me. Listen. This is the key. Listening will produce life for you. So, 26. And he said, if you will give earnest heed to the voice. I mean, he's trying to say it as strongly as possible. Not just listening, guys. Taking it in. Take in the voice and do what is right in his sight. And give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes. I will put none of the diseases on you, which I have put on the Egyptians. For I, the Lord, am your healer. Sounds like a transaction, doesn't it? But it's not. I think I want to take that and bring it into the next section. So hold on to that. And let's look at the deep layer here. Oh, and then so he makes this water sweet. This is a one-time thing. And then he leads them to where?
12 springs.
Yes.
70 day
palms. To Elim. And this is a famous oasis. I meant to look up, I think Christian and Lisa have pictures of where they think Elim was, that it's a beautiful place, like in the middle of the desert. It's this beautiful oasis there that has all sorts of things. So he brings them to a place that they get to, you know, camp out for a while, that has all of the necessary things that they need, water and food, plenty of shade in the desert, everything. And our correspondence, Jesus is our living water. If you go to John, you'll just find all the correspondence for Jesus over and over again. So, what's the deep layer? He says, I'm testing them. I'm showing them what's in their heart, that they don't really trust him. And I'm exercising and growing. So, these tests are not just to evaluate. These tests are to give them means and ways and reason to grow. I want to grow you in your trust here. So the test isn't just, don't you believe me? It's, here, I'm going to give you something out of some unusual situation. I want you to trust me. And I want you to trust that I am the one who can make you whole. When it says that I am your healer, the word healer is Rapha. We use that a lot. In names and things, Raphael is healer God. Jehovah Rapha, we call before we knew Yahweh Rapha. You'll see it actually in a lot of medical places, the word Rapha. There'll be a lot of different places there. But Rapha means to heal, but it's real. It's the full definition is to make whole. So it's not just diseases, but it's to make whole. I want you to know that I'm the one who can make you whole. And I'm going to do it in ways that you don't know or understand. I'm going to do it in ways that look really strange by throwing a tree into bitter water and making it fresh. By crucifying my own son to give you death, to give you life. I am the one who can make you whole. And I'm going to do it in ways that you never expected, in very unlikely ways. So he wants, this is how he's going to begin to test them, is I'm going to give you a need, and I'm going to have you wait and then see how I provide for you in a really strange and unusual way, so that you understand I can heal and make you whole in the midst of a wilderness. I can do that for you, and I will. So again, the deep layer is that he's going to provide. What he's doing in covenant for the first thing is protecting, separating to me, but now I'm going to provide. I'm going to provide you with what you need. I'm going to provide you with water. And then, of course, we go on to chapter 16, and we don't even have a day thing for this. They set out from Elim, and what is the first thing they do?
Grumble.
They grumble against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. So how do they grumble here? What do they say? What's the first thing they say? We'd much rather have died in here. This is the most interesting grumble. We'd much rather have died in Egypt where there was food. So I'd rather die looking at food than die in the wilderness not looking at food. That's a crazy grumble. I'd rather die near food than not.
Didn't they bring their flock?
They did, but they did not use them for food because of the amount of people they had. If they would have killed their flocks, it would have been a one-time thing. Okay. The flocks were there to eventually multiply and be their provisions.
So at least they were thinking ahead.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, people that are starving.
Okay, but are they starving?
No.
They were just at Elim. Mm-hmm. And they probably brought dates with them. So it probably hasn't been a long. We know. Right here, we know they've only been gone from Egypt since Passover, one month. We know, I mean, even if you count the days, we know that from the time they've had water provided, they've had, you know, all sorts of things. And it's the least amount of time they went through from without food or water is maybe a week, probably less. They would have you know, limited their palms and everything.
It's getting stale and it's getting old and it's getting not all the great variety of the wonderful things that they had.
Interesting, because if we go to Deuteronomy, it says actually that God made them hungry. He brought them to a place of hunger. He wanted them to be hungry. He didn't want them to be starving. He wanted them to be hungry. So he brings them to a place of hunger for a purpose. Because this is where they've been living. They've been living in Egypt. And Egypt is all about satisfying your desires and cravings immediately. Immediate gratification. This is the world they've lived in. And he wants them to get rid of that God, right? It is a God, immediate gratification. That's a God. And he wants them to get rid of it because it's not good for them. It's not helpful. It won't produce life for them. And he wants them to have this opportunity to be able to receive a gift that they wouldn't normally think it was a gift if they were still with immediate gratification. Because we know what gifts is coming, right? And if I just had a most wonderful feast, if I would just ate all of the stuff Yolanda brought, and then I walk out the door and God hands me a piece of manna, what do you think?
You'd be like, eh? You could grumble. You could grumble about that.
Exactly, exactly. He wants them to be hungry because he wants them to know that what I give you will satisfy. I don't want you to pass it up. They're hungry and they're not going to pass it up. So the hunger provides for them this opportunity of seeing what is really food. And he wants them to get rid of this immediate gratification. Can they live without eating until they give him, till he gives them the manna? Well, yes, of course. God knows how long they can go without food, and he's not going to let them go that way. They aren't anywhere near starving. But he wants them Remember, the whole thing, growing them up, is that they depend on him for everything.
It's funny because, you know, we make them, oh, I'm starving.
Yes,
really
we do. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We say those kinds of things. And that's probably exactly what they said. We're starving. We're starving.
Jill, the Channel 11 last night had the whole story of those miners.
Oh, really?
Nova.
Oh.
It took it through the whole thing. And for the first 33 days, they lived on a spoonful of milk and an ounce of cracker every other day.
There you go.
So they rationed.
Yeah. I remember they said they had rationed everything right at the beginning.
Everything.
Yep.
You can think about
it. Yep.
A spoonful of
and
milk.
Interesting
and
that they all, no one killed each other over
food. Yes,
well,
right.
What they said is that right away they had organization, that a person kind of took charge,
mm-hmm.
put them into groups, and they all worked. They had their 8-hour shifts, and they all did work, and they, you know, and so this is what kept them together.
Yep, yep.
But it was incredible. They showed the three different kinds of rigs that they had to dig and how they progressed, and so it took it through the whole thing. It was really.
Oh, I hope that'll be on again. I'll have to look for that.
Great.
Okay, so we have them hungry, and they're grumbling, and they. They want. They say it would be better for you to have just killed us in Egypt. That would have been much better. And we say things like that all the time. All the time. Okay. And so then, of course, God gives them the provision of food. And, of course, this is one of those stories that, wow, amazing, amazing. And the funny thing is, I often hear people say about the negative, they ate manna for 40 years. Every morning they ate manna. Interesting that we complain about that. So he directs them. He says, okay, I'm going to supply you with food, and I'm going to tell you exactly how to deal with this food that I'm going to give you. And so he gives them instructions on how to be able to have life out of the food that he's going to give them. So tell me about that. What do we know about how he gives them food? Okay, so he's going to give them what kind of food is he going to give them?
Manna.
We call it bread. He says it's bread. So he is going to give them bread every morning.
Gather only what you need.
Gather only what you need
for the day.
Don't store. Yep.
On the sixth day, gather twice.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, don't leave any of it till morning.
Right. Don't leave any of it till morning. And on the sixth day. You get double. Okay. Notice here that also at night he gave them, for a time,
meat,
quail, lots and lots and lots of quail. There were quail then, very few. And this huge, funny, National Geographic's month is on migration. And there's this huge migration that goes through Egypt at this time of all of these quail. And so they have meat for a long time. He tells them that he hears their grumbling. This isn't like, I hear that you're calling me and I hear you. He's going, I hear you. And he says it many times. I hear you grumbling. Okay, have you not as a parent said this? I heard what you said. I heard that you were stomping up the stairs. I don't want to clean my room. I've heard you. And it's really cool that he says this, because he says, I hear you grumbling against me. And I'm still going to be who I am. I'm still going to provide for you. I'm going to be who I am and continue to provide, even when you don't trust me, even when you're grumbling against me and don't think that I'm going to provide for you. I'm still going to do it. So he hears them, he feeds them, and then he also directs them not just about how they're to eat the food, but what else? What other thing does he tell them to do or not do?
Take a jar of it?
Before that.
There's they go and weigh it, and everyone has
the same. Isn't that interesting? That's interesting. That also applies, by the way, to the sixth day when they have to go out and get double. He basically gives them double of what they need. But then what are they supposed to do on the seventh?
Rest.
Mm-hmm. Take a Sabbath. This is the first time Sabbath is mentioned in the Old Testament, so it's an important passage we understand about Sabbath. Take a Sabbath. take a rest here. Don't do any work here. And we'll talk about that as well. So, how do they react? They do go and gather, right?
Yeah,
how do they do it?
They gather more. They don't follow the rules.
Right. Okay. So they don't listen, right?
They
go and they gather a lot. Some people gather a whole bunch. I would have been one of those. I would have gathered a whole bunch. Some people don't gather a lot, and they all end up with the same, exactly what God wants to give them, what they need. Then some of them decide to store it for another day. I'm not going to eat it all today. I'm going to hoard it so that I have more for tomorrow. And then it's filled with maggots. Okay, interesting. The maggots are actually, the word there is crimson maggots. These maggots are red. What does that remind you of? The blood of the Nile turning to death. I mean, all of these beautiful pictures of, they're crimson maggots. And what about Sabbath, when he tells them to take a Sabbath? What do they do then? Some of them.
Some of them go out and
work, right? And what do they get for their work? Nothing. Nothing at all. So we have God giving them directions of, look, I'm going to feed you, and here's how you deal with the food. Here's how you receive that food. And they don't listen. Some of them do this, some of that, and quite a few, obviously, when they...
Can I go back to verse 18, Joe?
Yeah.
This is the part that I wasn't clear on. Okay, when they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. So, like, no matter what, they eat it out, and everyone had the same? Or they said, are you gathered more?
No. When I've gathered more, and they put it on there, it was one of these miracles of the loaves. Put it on there, and it came out to an omer full. Every single one. So God made sure, no matter how hard they worked or how little they worked, everyone had exactly what they needed.
What they needed or the same?
I think...
It was by your family, right?
Yeah, it was by your... So yes and yes. So... every person had the same, except like the little baby, the little two-year-old didn't have as much as the old man because he didn't need that much. Does that make sense? So everyone had what they needed.
Okay, what they needed. So there wasn't, so if greed was a part of it, it was taken care of.
Right.
Okay.
Right, exactly. Okay, so what's the deep layer here? Again, he says to us and to them, I'm testing them. I'm humbling them. I'm showing them what's true. That they, it's not them working hard for it. So those who worked harder don't get more. Those who tried to work on the Sabbath don't get more. I'm trying to show them what's true. Whenever he says humble, is to show them, to have a correct assessment of what's true. What's true is I provide. I provide what you need. It's not you who work. And he's going to tell them this again in Deuteronomy. Once you get rich and you're satisfied and you go off and you think that you have produced all this riches, don't forget, I'm the one who gave you the riches. I gave you the ability to get the riches. It is me providing, always. So he does this to humble them, to grow them, to refine their understanding that his words are the food that will sustain them. Because in Deuteronomy he tells us, I fed them manna so that they would understand that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds of my mouth. How does he mean this? He's giving them food. But he gives them food in order to have them listen, to learn how to listen. It will be food for you exactly how I want to give it to you. It will be food for you when you gather it how I say. It won't be food for you when you decide to hoard it and keep it the way you want to. It's not going to be food for you then. It's not going to be food for you when you try to work harder. It's not going to be food for you when you try to not rest. My words are food for you. That's what will give you life. And I want you to understand this. And this is what he tells them. This is why I gave you the manna, so that you understand that listening to me, to my words, the words through my actions, are what will give you life. And he also says, I love the end of Deuteronomy, which we rarely go to. It says, I fed you manna to do good for you in the end, to to give you what you needed, and yet to give you exactly what you needed. Not what you wanted, but what you needed. What I knew as your parent you needed most of all. This is why I gave this to you. So the deep layer again is that he's providing. So what we've seen him doing in parting the Red Sea, in leading them to bitter water and then making it sweet again, leading them to be hungry, and then giving them this bread from heaven, which Jesus directly says, your forefathers in the wilderness had bread from heaven, but I'm telling you, I'm the bread from heaven. I actually am what you need to live. In doing this, he is working out covenant. And this is what where they could be living. Oh, he is working out covenant. He's providing for us. He's showing us that dependence on him is life. Does this make sense? More than just a miracle, it is you learning where life is coming from. So that you don't, when you get older and I take away the boundaries, that you don't think you can get life somewhere else. So when we look at the miracles, we need to look underneath them. We need to look beyond them to see what God is trying to teach us. These principles for life. Not that he provided us with this spectacular thing that we got to see. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yes? I'm seeing some faces that not quite true.
So was he trying to teach them like a transactional, like if you gather all this and you try to do it, you know, that whole thing?
Yep. Exactly. He is trying to bring death for them about a transactional life. Let that go. I want that to die. I want to show you my transformational world that I'm going to be providing for you all the time. We're going to go a little deeper in that. Let's look at this. What's God's purposes in all this? What he is trying to do is establish a rhythm for his newborns. He's establishing a rhythm. And you'll notice these commands that he gives throughout these three chapters. So I put it into four sections. Let's look at those four sections. He first says, stand by silently and see. Receive the word of his action on my behalf without trying to repay. Let's think about this. Have you ever been in a position where you're sick or incapacitated and somebody brings you a meal? Okay. Think about this. They're at the door. They bring you a meal. And the first thing you're thinking about is, oh, man, I got to go find money. Excuse me, wait, one minute. I got to go around the house and I got to get some money for you to give you for making me a meal. Anybody ever do that? I hope not. How would the person who brought you a meal feel?
They feel cheapened.
Absolutely. They would feel cheapened. And what is happening is you're not paying attention to the fact that they're giving you a gift to live so that you don't have to get out of bed, so that you don't have to make the meal. Instead, what are you concerned about?
Paying
back, making sure things are even, mm-hmm. having a transaction working out, right? We don't do that. Well, we don't do that immediately. Because mm-hmm. what we're doing is we're doing that in our head, mm-hmm. right? I'm receiving this meal and you're going, okay, tuck this back in so I remember I have to make a meal for them. Or I have to, my mother used to tell me, if anyone ever brings you something in a pan, when you return the pan, it has to be full.
Yeah.
That was a rule in our house.
Yeah, there you go.
Believe me, transactional world, I know all about. That was just a rule. What God is saying, stop. Stop your actions in your head or outwardly. Stop. And see what I'm giving you. See that it's a gift. Stop and see it and receive it. Just receive it. This is what the person at the door wants to do. Receive the meal. But I have gone and just tried to find something and I may have not even received the meal. Or I may have gone, oh, thank you very much. And I put it on the counter and I running around. In my head, mostly, right? In my head, I'm running around. I got to remember this. I got to fill. Oh, what am I going to fill this up with?
in this neighborhood, it happens all the time. Yeah. And I think it has just taught us all such grace. I can receive now.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Robert, I remember when you, I was like, it was like, are you kidding me? This is huge. And it was a pretty great thing. I really received it happily. I enjoyed everything. And you know what? Maybe the next time it won't be Robin. Maybe it'll be someone else. Mm-hmm. But you know that God will provide an opportunity. It's like when people have all this carpooling when I was teaching and I couldn't get, it was like, it may not be them that mm-hmm. I can help, but it's going to be someone else mm-hmm. that's going to need carpool help or whatever.
But it comes out of a different place
absolutely.
Than this transactional kind of thing. Yes.
Again. We have lots of opportunity to learn that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that has really been a huge lesson for me, too.
So what God, this is the beginning of the rhythm he wants us to see. I want you to be still in your mind, in your heart. I want you to be still so that you can see what I'm doing. If I'm not still in my mind, if I'm not still, I'm thinking about what I'm doing and I'm not seeing the gift. And I may completely pass over the gift then. Stay still in your mind, in your heart, so that you see what he's doing. Because if I don't see what he's doing, then I won't be able to sing about it later. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I won't be able to. So I'll give you an example. I remember when we had open house for this house. And it never occurred to me that people would bring things. It never even occurred to me. And so people started coming in with like gifts in their hand. And I was just a little taken aback. Like, oh. And I remember in my head just going, oh, that's nice. And somebody would come, oh, that's nice. And everyone leaving and seeing all these things and thinking, oh my gosh, I have no idea where all these came from. I don't remember. So I have no idea. I have no way to sing about it. I have no way to say, wow, thank you. That was so sweet and so thoughtful. But I was like, my mind started racing. Instead of receiving and just being in that moment, my mind's racing like, oh, they're giving me a gift. Oh, wow. I didn't expect that. What do I do? That kind of not being able to see the gift because I'm now thinking activity. So that's the first thing. And I call it stop and receive. Stop and receive. This is part of the pattern. And we'll talk about that in a minute with how an infant would do that. Instead of crying, eyes bawled. In fact, what does God say to Moses? Stop crying like a baby. Stop crying and receive it. Stop. Open up your eyes. Stop your activity and receive what mom has for you. She has a milk for you. So stop and receive. And then we go into the next chapter, sing. And sing is to reiterate what God has given you. Oh, God has provided me with protection. God has provided me with milk somehow. Say it again. Sing about it. Remember, when I sing about it, not just what he's done, but why he's done it. Say it again. And we'll talk about what that looks like. When I say what God has done. And this often we don't do this. We receive what God's given us, and we never tell anybody what he did. Okay, so a thank you note is telling the other person, right? So that is singing to God. Thank you, God, for this. But what it's also doing is planting it in you. It's planting deep in, God provided for me. God provided for me. Oh, it's this reminding. And why did God provide for me? Because of his loving kindness. Because he says I'm his child. Because he says he wants to protect me and provide for me within covenant. I say that to myself. I say that to God in order to plant it inside of me. Because if I don't re-say it again, I won't remember it, right? Many of you journal. How many of you journal? Oh, so a few of you journal. Gee! A few of you journal. This is a way to plant it inside of you. It's why Scripture says, thy word have I hid in my heart. That hiding is planting. Just like planting is hiding in the ground. It's really important that we do that. Because otherwise, when we come to times when things aren't happening, mm-hmm. we won't have any growth to see, oh, wait, I just have to wait because it's coming. It's coming. So I need to plant his word there. I need to plant what he's told me, what he's shown me, how he's acted on my behalf. Okay, that's the singing.
I made picture books.
Make picture books. All these ways and however way is best for you. But you need to say it in some way. You need to say it. And it's really helpful to say it to others because then not only you get the blessing, but they do. And what happens is they take that in, and go, so they're in a hard situation. They say, oh, but I remember how God provided for her. I'm going to look for God providing for me that way too.
And it builds your relationship because you're vulnerable about a need I had and how God
exactly. And you know, and that's really important. I'm glad you brought that up, Robin, because sometimes we don't share what God has done because we don't share our needs, our lacks. Oh, I'm having a hard time here. And then God meets us and we're great with it and we never share it because, of course, then we have to go back and say, well, I was vulnerable here. I needed this. All of that builds up one another. How? By bringing in the seed of his word, of what he's going to do, what he has done, how he provides, how he works out covenant. It helps us, again, live in the third layer. Does that make sense?
Jill, that's when Peggy said last week that they keep a prayer journal.
Uh-huh.
And when prayers are answered, because I tell my kids time and time again, if you pray for something, it's in God's time, it's not your time. And that was such a huge thing for me, because how many times are their prayers answered, but they don't realize.
Yes, yes, exactly.
It's not how they answered differently.
Right, right, right. But you're right. If I haven't said it in some way, written it down, said it to somebody, and that's fun because you can say, this is the need I'm asking God for, and it comes later in a different way, and maybe you don't see it, but they go, well, don't you remember? You prayed for this, and God, this is how God's answering. It's wonderful to be able to remind of that. So in some way, we need to sow that seed of his word. Does that make sense?
And also, like, calling it right when it's happening, because last
yes.
night there was a teacher, I mean, who messed up in class, and messed up at church. It was a good week. And I said, you know, I even got, like, teary. I said, that teacher gave you such grace. He didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are seeing the grace through others. And that's why
yes.
they talk about that
yes.
you're all a disciple.
Yes.
You all, you know, you can reflect God. You can, I mean, so it's not transactional. I'm
right.
going to write
right.
this teacher and say, thank you for giving Luke grace. It happened, and I called it.
Mm-hmm.
He knows it was
yes.
grace.
Yes. And that is exactly it, for us to be able to remind one another. This is how God's answering. This is how God is providing. This is how God is protecting. So it's important for us that we sow what has happened, what we've seen God do, what we know God is doing. It's really, really important. And we'll talk about that in...
My daughter was friends with a boy in Ecuador that died
right.
last week. And we went to his funeral. And he he's at St. Raphael's getting ready to take his confirmation. So he had written a number of things. He had some assignments
mm-hmm.
that he had to write. He had to read a gospel and write what was most meaningful to him and what verses spoke to him. And it was so beautiful. I thought, I want every one of my kids to write about their own faith, because it closed a lot of loose ends,
mm-hmm.
I think, for my daughter and maybe others. It said that the most meaningful thing to me in the gospel was the evidence of the resurrection.
Oh.
And that Jesus is who he said he was, the Messiah.
Wow. Wow. That,
for her
yeah.
not to know if he had any faith at all, but to let the priest say, this is where his faith was so meaningful to her, you know,
yep.
and to us. And
yes,
like,
yes.
It spoke.
Yes.
He spoke.
Exactly.
You believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you know?
Yep.
You're praying with your
right.
mouth, and it was proclaimed. And so I thought, gosh, I'm going to make my kids, maybe my Sunday school class, sit down and write where their faith is at.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
That is powerful
and
to be
the
able
timing
to do that.
Of it,
yes.
That he was
yeah.
able to record those things, you know, just recently.
Look what he did for everybody in.
Right.
Know,
exactly.
Like all these other teams that need that.
Yep.
Or,
yeah.
You know,
it was very moving. And
yeah. So the sowing of what God was doing for him and revealing to him,
you know,
has this huge fruit
yeah.
in ways that he wouldn't have known, nor anyone else.
Yeah,
and it will happen with you as well. So the sowing of his word within you is really, really important. And that is, as we looked at chapter 15, for the very beginning of chapter 15. Where is my chapter 15? There it is. How that's what Moses is doing here with the sons of Israel. He's sowing the words in, what God has done, what God has done, what God has done. God even tells them over and over, you know, review what I've done, review what I've done. But in 26, in verse 26, I want us to go through this a little bit more clearly right now. So we're supposed to reiterate what he's done, that planting, that sowing in. If I don't do that, I'm not going to remember his faithfulness, and I'll come to another hard time, and I'm not going to be as likely to listen. I'll be looking for another answer somewhere because I won't remember that he's actually been faithful before. But he also tells us to listen. So sow and grow. And why did I put grow here? I want us to look at this 26. He said, give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight. Now we look at that and we go, oh, sounds like a transaction. Sounds like I'm supposed to do. When I put a seed in the ground, I listen. I bring it into me. We talked about bringing his word in, consuming it. When it's in me, it's hidden, right? It's being planted. But what happens when the food is within me? What does it do in my body? It nourishes me in order to have energy, right? Life, right? Did I force that food? Did I say, okay, food, make me have energy?
No.
It was a natural process, right? The natural process of consuming his words will come out in a natural way by doing what he said, by following his instructions. That will just come it will not be a striving. Striving comes when I haven't consumed his words. I've seen his words maybe, or I've just said, well, in order to get this, I need this, so I'm going to try to do this. There's a subtle difference there, and yet huge. If I take in his words and I let them become a part of me, they naturally begin to grow. They naturally will give me life and energy, and I will follow instructions. But when I don't listen, when I don't consume his words, they might be over here, oh yeah, I heard that. Or I think, I got to do this in order to be good. I got to do this in order to get this. I'll strive, and it won't come out naturally. Does this make sense to you? So this part of heeding his voice and then doing what is right, it always comes from hearing his voice. And not just hearing, but taking heed, that consuming and letting it break down, being hidden, and then starting to grow.
Jill, I think about other things that we dwell on also. We'll have the fruits will come.
Absolutely.
Out
absolutely.
Uh-huh. Whatever we're dwelling on.
Right.
You know,
whatever we're consuming and letting become part of us. Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, we think if I'm eating sugar all day, I'll just work it off. But in truth, it's actually causing my body to work in a different way. Which isn't a healthy way. It's producing, the insulin is coming and going over work and all of that. So doing what is right is this natural thing that comes out of it. And then he says again, give ear to his commandments and keep. And that word keep we've talked about over and over again. That word keep is to tend as a garden. Tend as a garden. So when I take in his words, then I need to not just consume them, but tend to them, water them, think about them, meditate on them, bring them to fruition, not by striving to do, but chewing on them, thinking about them. This stuff about listening and taking in and tending like a garden so that it begins to grow. When I first take in the word, it seems hidden. It seems like there's nothing happening, but it begins to grow and it begins to grow. But I can't get fruit out of it right away, right? It's going to be growing here. This time of sowing and growing is really a time of waiting. It's a time of, I don't see everything that's going to be with this, but I'm willing to wait for this. I don't plant a tomato bush in May. And then June 1st thinking, well, where are those fruits? I've got to cut that down because there's no fruits, right? I'm willing to wait until the end of July before I start to see tomatoes come out. And I don't pick them until they're red, right? So there's this time of waiting, knowing that I will be provided for. But there is this waiting time, and the waiting time makes the harvest, the reaping time, that much sweeter, right? Because it's like, oh, I mean, don't, in the middle of winter, are you not waiting for a real tomato? Not a store tomato, but a real one. Are you not, even in June, you're waiting. You see those little yellow blossoms, and you're just waiting. Boy, that first red tomato, oh, it's so good. But I've waited knowing that I will be provided for. So we have stop and receive. This is the pattern, the rhythm that God is trying to put within us, within his infant Israel. Sow and grow. This time of waiting, bringing his word. He said he would do this. I'm going to let it sit in me. I'm going to let it grow in me. And then we have, he tells them to gather and to eat. They're supposed to daily gather it. Daily take in his words and consume them, all of them. Here's what we often do, though. We often go, oh, yeah, that was, I heard that, but I'm not going to consume it yet. I'm not going to let it grow yet. That was nice. You know, so I have, let's say I have daily devotions every day, and I go through it, I read the word, and I walk away, and I leave it right where it was on my little couch there. I don't consume it and let it grow in me that day. Anybody do that?
Yes.
Yeah. What happens with the manna that they set aside?
It becomes worms,
red maggots. It becomes death. What he gives you for that day, the words he gives you for that day, are important to consume them for that day. Because if I don't, they become death. They become without flesh. So he says, Jesus is the word incarnate, and he calls us to do the same with his word, to incarnate it, to make it flesh, make it live, make it grow. And when I don't, I say the word is no longer incarnate. It's discarnate. It is no longer flesh.
It becomes the law.
It becomes law. And it sits there and becomes maggots, red maggots. So this taking in his, he daily is going to give us words. And here's the interesting thing. I really, for me, this was a good thing. He says, you can try to today I'm just going to consume it all. And I'm going to read 5 chapters today. And God says, I'm going to give you what you need for today. And if you do 5 chapters and your neighbor reads a verse, your neighbor just prays and hears your voice, you're both going to get what you need for the day. That's all you need, is that. So this hoarding isn't any good. And the hoarding, I can't consume it all. I can't make it all. Just like, think about this. If you sit down for a meal, and when I look at Yolanda's pumpkin thing, and I think, yeah, everyone's going to leave, and I'm going to eat the whole thing. What's going to happen to me? I'm going to get sick, right? I mean, probably, if I just... I'm going to get sick. I take what I need for the day. Taking in his word, letting it grow, gathering it every single day, and allowing it to grow every day is God saying, this is the rhythm. Now remember, he's saying this to newborns. So here's the rhythm I'm giving you. I'm going to give you what you need. I'm not going to stuff. Okay, for a newborn, you're not going to say, man, you know what, tonight I'm going to be really busy, so I'm going to give you 2 bottles right now. And tonight I'm not going to feed you, right? We won't do that, right? We have a rhythm for them. We give them, I mean, and if I remember correctly, if you were, obviously, you know, if you're nursing, actually,
they better get on a rhythm, right?
Well, yeah. But interesting enough, your body produces a rhythm for that baby. And actually, the baby, until you introduce sugar into his diet, the baby has a natural rhythm of how much to eat. Until sugar is produced in it. Until sugar is introduced into a baby's diet, they know exactly how much to eat. So God has already provided these rhythms. There's times for eating, there's times for gathering, and times for eating and consuming. And then, what's the next thing?
Rest.
There's time for rest. And he says, I want you to rest here. And the rest, and he says, the Sabbath is to the Lord. or for the Lord. In other words, it's a time of rest to be thinking, reflecting on how he's been working out covenant for you. It's this reflective rest. It is not, and this is, we go all different ways. Okay, how can I observe the law of Sabbath and still do my own thing, right? In fact, there is scripture that says, if on Sabbath you go and do your own thing, you are not observing Sabbath. Sabbath, he says, is a time for resting and realizing, oh, I am so content in what God's given me. And this is what God's given me. This reflecting that God has actually worked out covenant for me. So what we have here is this, the exact thing we do with a newborn. We stop crying. Receive what I have for you. Because the baby can cry and cry and never see that you're giving him, you're trying to give him milk, right? Stop. Receive. Sow and grow. Remember, and of course a baby doesn't remember so much as the brain begins to observe that every time this figure comes in and she has this in her hand or she starts to unbutton her blouse, that's food for me. That becomes a, oh yeah, every time I see this, oh, this is food, this is food, this is the sowing. I remember this is food, this is food. And let it take it in. Take it in. Let it produce the energy and the growth for me. Sow and grow. Take it in every time it's offered. Every single time it's offered, take it in. Don't refuse it. Eat it. Allow it to become part of you. And as it becomes part of you, the baby has energy to do things. But then, rest. So we have this rhythm that God is saying, here's how life in my kingdom will work really well. If you succumb to this rhythm, there will be vitality for you. You will thrive. My whole purpose for you is to give you a life where you thrive. That's, as we went through Sermon on the Mount, that was the whole thing, is these are things that will give you life. In my kingdom, the things that are there will give you life. Do you see this rhythm he's putting us in? Here's a rhythm for you. Here's a rhythm for you. This rhythm will give you life. Eventually, he'll let go of the rhythm and he'll say, you can choose, but the rhythm will still work for you. So we can choose to not sow. We can choose to not rest. We can choose to not stop. And we'll get along okay, but eventually, and interesting enough, as people get older, they begin to go back to this exact same rhythm, naturally. And they've done studies, as people get older, they actually go back to sleeping 8 to 10 hours, if not more, which is the rhythm God made your body to do, not sleeping less. And they'll notice that an older person, less activity, will rest, and they need to be able to do that. It's the natural rhythm God has given you. So, if I don't rest, let's go to these. If I don't listen, if I don't take it in, I'm not going to follow those instructions. It's not going to come naturally. If I don't follow the instructions, then I'm going to work harder, right? I'm going to work all the time. I'm going to try to get what I want. And I'm not going to get any more than God ever intended me to get. If I don't consume what he's given, it'll turn into death for me. But if I don't rest, I'll keep working and I'll have no life. And we even say this, I have, right? When I'm working all the time, I have no life. Yeah, that's exactly it. God says that's exactly it. You are speaking truth. You have no life. Because what happens is I keep working, I have no food, no rest, therefore I have no capacity to take in life. Because I have no capacity then to stop and receive. If I continue to work and work and not rest, then I have no capacity to receive. Because what happens? The harder I work and the more I work, the more I feel entitled to what I have. And when I feel entitled to what I have, then I get mad at other people for getting things that they didn't work for. And I start seeing the world as a transaction. And if it's a transaction, then I have a really hard time receiving a gift, right? So do you see that this is a pattern? And when I get out of this pattern, I interrupt the way to thrive. Now, the interruption is the important thing. So how does Israel try to repurpose life? They walk by sight. They live in those first two layers. And when I walk by sight and live in the first two layers, my reaction is going to be fear. My first reaction is going to be fear. And when I fear, then I will grumble. And here's grumbling. Let's completely flush out the definition. Grumbling, we've talked about this, is to complain, kind of behind his back. Pat said to be obstinate. The real definition is to stop progress, to stop me from going forward. In other words, to interrupt the rhythm. God has this rhythm for me, and my grumbling interrupts the rhythm that he has that will bring me to thrive, to have this life. Here's the interesting thing. I'm thinking about this. So my grumbling actually stops that rhythm. I'm talking to Lisa tonight. She called me. She said, I have this presentation, and it's all about cancer. And then, and as Lisa always does, she always says, so tell me what your lesson's about. Kind of just, you know, go over it with me. And I kind of told her. And then she said, it's interesting that you're talking about rhythm. Because do you know what cancer cells do? And of course, as soon as she said, I'm thinking, oh my gosh. Cancer cells, what they do is they interrupt the normal process of cell growth and death. Because cancer isn't a cell dying. Cancer says, I refuse to let the regulators let the cells die, the old cells die. They make the old cells keep living on and on and on, and they keep multiplying and multiplying and multiplying. No death. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of growth. That's what a cancer cell does. Think about this. If the wilderness is a place for me to have God bring death for me of the things that were of Egypt, and I grumble and say, I don't like this, I'd rather be back in Egypt, I'm allowing that to grow and grow and grow. I stop the rhythm of him letting those waiting times, letting the seed die in the soil, letting me wait to be hungry. I refuse to go forward. I refuse to go in that rhythm of dying and living and dying and living. This is the natural rhythm. This is what gives us life. I refuse, just like a cancer cell. What eventually happens with a cancer cell? Right? It overtakes everything. So this cancer cell that keeps growing and growing and growing, it completely overtakes. And that is real death. Right? There is what grumbling is. Grumbling is cancer. It stops the rhythm of death and life, of times of waiting, times of allowing God to take away my God of immediate gratification, letting that die. Grumbling is saying, I don't want that to die. I want to grow it more and more. I want to keep that. Does this make sense to you? This is one of those, see, grumbling isn't just a, oh, you know, he was grumbling. No, grumbling stops the rhythm that God intends for you. And it grows and it grows. And of course, this is what we're going to see all in the wilderness. The grumbling has grown these. They're holding on to that immediate gratification. They're holding on to living by sight rather than by faith. Living in those first two layers rather than that third layer. Grumbling is stopping that rhythm that God is trying to instill in them. So what happens? Now we talked about, at the very beginning, the question was, what purpose is there in putting a baby on a schedule? It's really to help him thrive, right? Mm-hmm. To have a rhythm in his life. What happens when the rhythm is broken? Chaos. And it starts little, right? He's crabby. And then it grows because it means you're crabby, right? Mm-hmm. And then you take him out to Target and you actually make more people crabby, right? And so we all of a sudden now we have this growth of his grumbling. It becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And now, not only do we have just people crabby, so we have three levels of people crabby. Now he's cried so much and is so crabby, now he can't sleep. And when he can't sleep, then he can't digest food properly. And he can't grow properly. And pretty soon, if it keeps on going and I don't impose that rhythm back into him, he gets sick, right? So this rhythm is for life. And the stopping produces a cancer that grows. So God is trying to instill in us, newborns, rhythm. Rhythm. Rhythms are for life. A rhythm of, and I love that we're in the fall, the rhythm of dying. Allow the rhythm. I mean, have any of you, okay, as soon as I said that, I thought, that's me. Has any of you tried to stop the cold from coming?
No.
Yeah, all my blankets. I just had to have Bill, two loadfuls of blankets, of sheets. Yeah, over everything, because I'm trying to stop the death. No, God, I don't want him to die yet. I don't want him to die yet. That's that stoppage of this. I have a rhythm, Jill, and my rhythm produces life. So not your rhythm, my rhythm.
So you're going to put the blankets away now?
I did. I had them washing there all the way. I'm not touching them again.
No, but you're going to be tempted with them, though, mm-hmm. So you need to get rid of them.
Get rid of blankets? Oh, man, Yolanda! Oh. I'll have to think through that one.
Sorry.
Yeah. That's probably a good thing. Yes. Oh. That would be hard. And it's just as hard for you in other places in your life to stop the grumbling. Because remember, the grumbling is, I don't like what you're doing, God, mm-hmm. But I don't trust you. I don't trust that what you're bringing is really going to be life. I don't trust that.
You know, I can't tell you how many times I've said, people talk about the fall, it's their favorite season, how many times I've said, not mine because I know winter's coming. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what I'm doing.
It's exactly what you're doing.
I'm not going to do that anymore.
Yep, exactly. And winter, think about this. I mean, so many of us, we think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to live in a place that was all, I don't think summer. Yeah. I think fall or spring. But wouldn't it be nice to be in a place that's always this, like always summer? Think about your own body. Your body would be exhausted if there wasn't a time where you actually pull back a little and your activities lessen a little. Now, do we try to do that? Yeah, we do. We try to do that even when winter comes and we try to defy it. But God says, I actually have a rhythm that produces life. You can go with it. I mean, at this point, we're not newborns anymore. So he says, you know, you don't have to stick with the rhythm. But I'm telling you, rhythm is still good. Rhythm is still a good way to go.
There was something, I don't know if it was an article, and I don't know if it was something that I read recently or saw, but it was something about like the act of complaining. And does it really, you know, help you get it off your chest? I had an article somewhere, a doctor's office or something, and it said, no, it really does not. You think it's cathartic? It's not. It really doesn't. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't make your marriage better. It doesn't make your, you know, you blow off some steam. And I still am in the camp where, okay, at least grumble, get it over with, get it out. Mm. But it really doesn't help.
And what I find is if you complain, and then I feel guilty.
Now, remember, if we go into some of the prophets and some of the Psalms, there is a place and a time for complaining. And where is that place?
Straight to God.
And you go, and when I complain to God, it's going to sound a lot different, isn't it? God, I don't know why you're doing this, and I really don't like it, but I want to believe that it's working covenant. I want to believe this. And this is why I sow his word. This is what you did, and this is why you did it. Because you're working covenant out. As I'm sowing this, when I go to complain to God, when I actually say, God, I don't like this, but I know from my sowing, you're working covenant out. And I want to see it. Can I see it? God has no problem with that. He has no problem. But the grumbling behind his back stops the rhythm. And it just says, I don't want to go any farther, God, with what you have. When I grumble to him, and it's not grumbling, when it's staying in conversation, then I'm allowing him to answer me I'm going to want you keeping in rhythm. I want you staying in rhythm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So this grumbling is a big deal. A big deal.
Mm-hmm.
It stops the rhythm. Let's look at it just from the baby's point of view. So when I refuse to stop and receive, in other words, when he says to Moses, why are you crying? Go and receive. When I am not willing to stop, I'm not going to see what he has. When the baby is not willing to stop crying and open his eyes, he's not going to see that mom has her breast right there for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that you've all seen that at some point or not. What happens is I'll start to act on my own behalf. I won't see what he has because I'm crying and I'm screaming and I'm grumbling and I won't even see what he has.
And the baby crams his fists in his mouth.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I'll start to go, oh, I'm going to try to get something on my own. You've seen a baby try to suck on other things, right? Yeah, you know, he's looking for something, he's just going to suck on it. And my activity in thought, and I want to particularly say that, my words in thought will obscure what God's doing. Stop. Be silent. Allow the time to see him. And since I don't see his protection, then I'll start defending myself,
mm-hmm.
right? And grumbling often comes up with I start defending myself. Grumbling can happen at any point in the rhythm, but it's going to break the rhythm when you do. When I refuse to sow and grow, when I refuse to remember that I have been satisfied before, and it's that growing time, that waiting. I've been satisfied before. God will provide for me again. When I don't do that, I'll forget his faithfulness. When I don't review what he's done, I'll forget that he's done these things. And I do love it, though, when somebody else reminds me. Well, remember back then when God did that for you? That's really helpful if I haven't remembered. In forgetting that he's the source of life, then I'll start listening to other voices. And I'll start thinking, oh, life is somewhere else. I can produce life on my own. And we've talked about this so many times. When I refuse to reap and eat, I'll not seek his words daily. I'll not look for the bottle or the breast. I'll look for something else. I'll look for a blanket to start sucking on. And does the blanket ever give me any nutrition? It never does. But I got it, and I get to suck on it. Which is exactly what we do with other things instead of his word being. And that's why he says this. He says in old and new, man does not live by bread alone. Man lives by every word that proceeds out of my mouth. When I refuse to reap and eat, I'll set aside some of his words for another day. But what happens when you set aside milk for another day?
It spoils.
It curdles. To me, ugh. Curdled milk, that is why I never drank milk as a kid. Because my parents didn't drink milk, and so it would sit in there forever and ever, and you'd put it out, and it would curdle. And that's disgusting. And those missed meals will become inedible to me, and I'll look to feed myself on my time. When I refuse to rest reflectively, in other words, to be content in my fullness, and that God satisfied me, and I can rest, I'll forget that life is his gift and his word is my food. And I'll fall into the cycle of transaction. I have to work for what I'm getting. So there is a cycle of transaction. And he's saying, no, come into my rhythm and it'll be transformation all the time. In fact, there's never a striving in this rhythm. Do you see this? There's never a striving. When he says to go out and get the food, it's there. It's provided for. Just pick it up. All they have to do is pick it up. They didn't have to... to till ground. They didn't do anything for this food. All they had to do was receive it. Pick it up. Just pick it up. Take the bottle. And then I'll be unlikely to receive his gifts. And in stopping the rhythm of his nurturing me to life, I will fail to thrive. So in my life, when I stop the rhythm, when I'm grumbling, when I'm saying, I don't like this, I'm not going to stay in this rhythm of stopping, receiving, sowing his word, reminding myself what he's done, letting it grow in me, waiting for him to produce food for me again. And then eating what he gives me and consuming it and making it a part of me completely. And then resting with satisfaction. That rest, that Sabbath rest of satisfaction should be a, oh, I'm completely satisfied. I have not gone without because God has provided. That cycle causes me to thrive. And what happens when I grumble is I shake the shalom. I completely cut off peace. Because when I'm starting to strive, when I'm starting to not want to go in that rhythm, there will be a lack of peace for me. That shalom, that wholeness. It doesn't, and it is not talking about your circumstances. Because with the rhythm, I'm beginning to live on the third layer. I'm beginning to live looking that he's actually providing and working out covenant. When I stop, when I grumble, I walk out of that third level, I go back to the first level and only what I see. And I start striving. And every time I live by what I see, I get afraid. And then I grumble. And see what I've done? I've started myself in a cycle of grumbling and transactions. So seeing that is underneath what's happening with these miracles. I want us to see the miracles for what they are, but then thus underneath is even more powerful than what the miracles are. So let me ask you, what applications do you come out of for those three things? Grumbling, manna, God's nurturing rhythm. What thoughts for yourself come out of that?
I mean, just hugely going to God with it. I'm very busy grumbling to everyone around me. You know? And I might couch it when you go to sleep. Boy, I'm really frustrated with it. But, you know, but that's huge. Is there ever, I mean, like, we are human.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't know why I could, like, get rid of all the grumbling. I mean, I know what we said. We just sat here for
you
talking about
give it to
grumbling.
God.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Not to others, but just take it from them.
I think one of the reasons grumbling is like when we remember what God has done, it causes us to remember. Well, every time we grumble, it's like we're setting it, we're etching it in again and again and again. It's like, okay, this is what God's not providing. This is not providing.
Right. 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 Exactly. And so, Jill, to answer your question, they grumble and God still provides, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I just stop and receive what he's given me, even in the midst of my grumbling, the more I stop and receive it, there's a way to get back into that rhythm. Oh, a way to get back into that rhythm. Just like a baby. So a baby grumbles. A baby's going to cry and not always do it. Does that mean you say, oh, well, you know, it's too late. I can't stop him from doing that. I mean, do we? We continue to bring about ways to get back in that rhythm, right?
But if there's something that I'm mulling over, I can talk to Carmel. I have to talk to people about stuff, you know.
And no problem to talk to people about stuff. First and foremost, remember, he says this, stay in the conversation with him first. Absolutely stay in the conversation with him first. Tell him about it. And here's the thing. If I'm actually talking to him, and if you remember Philippians, how we pray, talking, say, okay, God, I don't like this, but I know you're working out covenant. How are you working out covenant? If I have this conversation with him, the conversation I have with Carmel about what just happened will be, I don't get it. But God said he's working out covenant. So here's the conversation. It'll probably turn out is, do you see any way God's working out covenant here? That the conversation is going
to
change.
And then to be sure, I go back to her and say,
yes, exactly. Or even asking her, could you help me look for how God's working out covenant?
Oh, that's huge.
That's huge. That, okay, now what we've just done is relationship and relationship, that circle God wants us to have, that relationship with one another and him, that completely changes. And what changed is I first went to God and talked to him about it, had this conversation to him about it, and now it changes my perspective, which is exactly what prayer is all about. If I have a conversation with him, think about this. I can think about something all day. Bill didn't do this. Whoa. And I think about it all day, but I don't ask him, did you not bring in the paper today? Why didn't you bring in the paper today? And the whole time, all I needed to do was say, hey, Bill, did you bring in the paper? Yeah, I did, but it slid under the car. Sorry. or it wasn't there. But if I had no conversation with him all day, what happens? I build it up, and I build it up, and I build it up. And by the time he gets home, he walks in the door, I say, thanks a lot for not bringing the paper. Right? All I needed was a conversation. One conversation immediately. This is with God. Something happens, God, I don't get it. Well, how come you didn't bring in the paper today, God? Oh, I did, Jill. Wait. That conversation... And that's why everything builds on one another. Staying in the conversation with God will inform the conversations with others. If it's first. If it's first.
Well, think of your body. I mean, my stomach's grumbling right now because I denied it some food. You know, it needed to be sustained. So it's going to be making noise until I decide to feed it. And, you know, it's going to be back into its rhythm of how God created it.
And if you feed it garbage...
Right.
But, you know, and then in thinking of rhythms, it's like birth control, you know? We choose, you know, how we're going to control other children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by, you know, God did truly create a rhythm.
Absolutely
in that,
did, right.
Like, you know,
right.
If you really trust me, and I just want you to have three kids, you're going to have three kids.
Right.
You know, so that's another way we've interrupted God's rhythms.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting they say that, because what is one way of birth control called?
Rhythm method, right?
Yeah.
Which is avoiding God's rhythm.
Okay, what else?
Just the idea of grumbling being a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I think I will always remember that. And it's a cancer that you can give somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
It's a contagious cancer.
Yeah.
And just the idea that grumbling makes you stop from your growth because you're putting your effort into grumbling. And it's that thing with the brain, 90 seconds when something happens,
right.
Your body reacts to it within 90 seconds. And after that, it's your conscious decision
to choose to put in the other side.
What
she's talking about is that they've done research that anything that happens emotionally, your body reacts for 90 seconds over something. After 90 seconds, you have a choice to store it on the other side of your brain or to let it go. So an emotion more than 90 seconds is a choice that you made to store. So that's exactly what she's saying, is that grumbling, I've chosen. Oh, this happened. I didn't like it. Now, I can choose to grumble about it, or I can take it to God. So that's a good way to look at that. Anything else? Any other applications? What about manna? What about that taking in His word? Anything about that?
Yeah, take it and eat it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Don't set it aside,
because
then it becomes death. Mm-hmm. It becomes spoiled.
Yeah.
And we need it every day, and God will give us what we need. But we need to take what He gives us each day.
Yep.
Even as we have to walk through the entrails.
Exactly, yeah. Sometimes it's not,
It's just hard to chew.
Exactly, yes.
And it's not like manna is like this perfect, right? I guess I always thought of it as like it's only the good stuff.
Maybe
it's
not
going to be the most tasty.
Uh-huh.
It's not Turkish delight.
No, it said it tasted like honey cakes or something.
It was a wafer that had a honey taste to it. So I don't know about you, but I think wafers are pretty cardboardy. So you have both. You have the bland and the honey as well. I don't like honey, so I wouldn't like manna. So we have. I want us to think again that rhythm of putting a child in that rhythm, God putting us in a rhythm. And the good of that rhythm and the freedom, because we're going to, you know, Israel grows as we do, and He's going to give us the freedom. I've set out what is good. I'm going to give you the freedom to choose it or not. And, you know, a lot of times we forego the rhythm. Okay, so you have an infant and we have a party or something and we forego the rhythm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's okay. You pay for it a little bit, though, don't you?
Yeah.
At some point, you know, you do. But it's okay. It doesn't completely make the child sick, but a constant going out of the rhythm is not a good thing for your body. Talk to people who work night shift.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough, always. Always. So, I think we'll end there. Let me pray. Father, thank you that you know so much what we need for life. Thank you that what we need for life, we don't always understand or see, but we can trust that you will give us what is good for life. We can trust your rhythm. Father, we pray that this week each of us might recognize our own grumbling within our minds, even our actions, Lord, that show that we're grumbling, even if we don't say it. May we recognize those. May we recognize them for the cancer they are, for the way it stops the rhythm that will cause us to thrive in life. And Father, as we recognize those, may we also recognize the grace you give us, the grace to be able to come back into the rhythm, to have life from you, to be fed by your hand. May we recognize daily your words that you're bringing us. May we consume them. May they become a part of us and be produced as energy, not just for you, but for us, that we might realize in the end, you provide us the bread of life so that we have good, that we have life. Father, might our hearts be still as we receive what you have for us this day. In Jesus' name, amen.